Welcome to Artist Materialist. I'm Susanna, an artist and graphic designer.
I'm Dan, a material scientist.
And this week, our long read is titled, All Mental Disorders Are Brain Disorders, Not, by Ico Fried, who is a psychologist, researcher. Psychologist and academic who's written a lot of papers on the subject of mental disorders and has strong opinions about the way that research is being conducted over the last couple of decades and how research is being funded and how results are being interpreted. So this was a little bit of a something out of left field for me. I'm curious to know how you came across this.
One of the people I follow on Twitter is Von Bell, who is a psychiatrist, and this was retweeted by him, and the piece actually says up at the top that it's in response to something that Von Bell wrote for a conference, and that was a talk about why we need to get better at critiquing psychiatric diagnosis. So I think it's really interesting to have in one place a psychologist responding or adding on to a psychiatrist, and then both talking about how they go about thinking very inside baseball about diagnosing mental illness and just thinking about that and where the trends are going with regard to the profession.
It was very interesting to read about because I have been exposed to mental illness diagnoses on the, you know, the patient end of it and the sort of the regular, you know, everyday people end of it, and not so much from the clinical understanding, other than what I've just read myself, you know, online in publications like Wired or The Atlantic. So I did not know so much about the clinical details of how mental illness is diagnosed and what the current trends are. But it was interesting to read that the National Institute of Mental Health, starting around the late 90s, focused so exclusively, at least in terms of research and funding, on functional MRIs and anything that was biologically related.
Yes, and that led to my favorite scientific poster that I've ever seen, which I actually got to meet the person who did it, where they were using some very underpowered statistical methods, or maybe overpowered, to try to figure out things from these functional MRIs. And then, so this grad student actually just took a salmon, just the whole fish, and put that in the functional MRI. And and he was able to, you know, and showed the dead salmon some different, you know, played some sounds for it or showed it some different things that, of course, it couldn't perceive because it was a dead salmon. And he was able to, using the standard for the time statistical results, show that there was a statistically meaningful difference that he was able to tease out, and he had it on his poster, and you could see the little colored voxels of the tiny brain of the dead salmon.
That is wonderful. And it really goes to show what Fried is talking about here, that there's too much, people are reading too much into the data. They're teasing out statistical significances that really aren't there if you look at a larger sample size or do some more rigorous mathematics. And he says that when fMRI first came out, people were so excited at the possibilities of it that a lot of papers were published with very small sample sizes, just because it was so new and expensive to get a lot of samples at that time. And then, of course, later papers refer to the earlier ones, which are maybe not so well done, and the earlier ones sort of become canon, even if they are not the best data sets.
Yes, I think that it can be easy to go too far in saying that the science wasn't even necessarily bad. It was that we took the wrong thing away from it, is that we shouldn't have been taking away that this is a absolutely true statement about how people are. But what was really valuable was that it was these early papers were developing a method that can tell us stuff that we didn't know before, that before we didn't have a way of seeing what's happening in the brain in real time. And so these early papers, well, they need some sort of hypothesis, some sort of experiment to run to try to see something. And just in the process of trying, you know, they may fall short of actually showing what they intend to show, but the development along the way is really valuable. And you can certainly find out things with fMRIs that we didn't know before. And it's valuable research, but what happens is that it gets so hyped that we showed X causes Y, and it's such a nice, clear story that it gets oversold. And it's like, well, it's a much sexier thing than describing what's actually happening in terms of, well, there's increased blood flow in this area of the brain, and now we can tease out that this is happening in the brain during mental tasks. It's a lot more nuanced.
That's a good point. And I know that the layperson doesn't find papers that are about developing a method nearly as interesting as papers that show some sort of result. But I would argue that, especially, like you said, when a technology is new, those are even more important, saying that you've developed a more reliable method for running these sorts of studies. Okay, we, after doing so many tests and looking at all these papers, we have determined that the best way to run these is to have the patient asleep or awake, and to do it for this long or this many times and mm-hmm. at this time of day and all those things. That's really, really useful information. But yeah. Again, it doesn't make headlines.
Right. It's not necessarily what's going to get you in the high impact journal, and it's not necessarily what's going to get written up by the university public relations office to be pushed out. And those are the ones that get a lot of attention, are the ones that get written up as a PR release or that get published in the super high impact journals. And those are the ones that disseminate to the talk shows and to the evening news or whatever. That's what we end up seeing. We don't see the hard grind of the intermediate tasks, although it seems like it's maybe changing. And
I would argue, though, that the peers of the people who are doing the sort of method-based research or publishing about new methods would appreciate that a lot more. And in the long run, that will get you more citations and more respect among your peer group of fellow researchers, because they are going to use what you discovered and they're going to cite what you discovered in all of their subsequent research.
I agreed. Methodological advances are really a underappreciated way to get a lot of citations if you can be found.
Yes. And that's going back to the article, something that Fried sort of argues for. So he's talking about how all mental disorders are not necessarily brain disorders, and how the diagnostic tools that we have right now are too vague, they are not well tested enough, and it seems to me that he is arguing for looking more rigorously at diagnostic tools and maybe looking more rigorously at classifications of diagnoses themselves.
One of the things that I learned reading this article and then following along to other things is the sort of something that's I've never had quite set in my head before is why is it that the DSM-5, as they start working on 6, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is very much used in the US, why is that in psychiatry and there isn't something similar in psychology?
That is a good question. I had never considered that.
This is something that's bothered me. So I'm a material scientist, but I had thought at various times in my life about going into psychology, and so I've taken classes and read work on my own, and even took the psych GRE once upon a time. And that's something that I've kind of wondered about, and what it comes out reading, especially the Linked Von Bell piece, is that the DSM is done that way. And that's the one that gets used because it is much more kind of like the TV show House. The process of making a differential diagnosis is a very medical task. And what's further was very interesting to me is that even in the US, and certainly internationally, and even in the US, official diagnoses are kind of really not even in the DSM. They're in this other thing called the ICD, which is the International Statistical Classification for Disease and Related Health Disorders. And I think that's that extra related health disorders says a lot. And that covers just any way that you can be unwell and die is all grouped in together. And the codes for mental disorders and mental health issues are put into that.
So instead of separating them out into a separate diagnostic manual, they're just included in the whole big diagnostic manual of everything.
Yes. And when Von Bell was talking about his the critiques that are made of psychiatric diagnosis, he, as a psychiatrist, was kind of contrasting that with a psychological approach. And he was saying, well, one critique that he gets is that you could say that all of these different things are just different ways of describing distress. And that's, there's sort of just this distress bucket. And, in sort of integrative psychology and the idea that you're either well or you're unwell. And if you try to tease it out too much, you're really going into this biological reductivism or reductionism, rather. And on the one hand, you can just kind of put everything into one bucket, but at that point, it doesn't really tell you a lot of things about what to do about it. And so the diagnostic manual, if you approach it in a structured way, you can get repeatable diagnoses. But if you take sort of an ad hoc approach, then yes, you're not going to get very repeatable diagnoses because if you do it one way one time and one way another time, then you're not being scientific and so you're not going to get repeatable results. And I think that's what Eiko Fried was building off of, this idea that if you don't take a scientific approach, then you're not going to get scientifically repeatable results, including for these classification types of diagnoses. And that also applies to this idea of trying to find a brain structure or brain chemical interpretation for every psychological behavior or mental health issue.
Okay. And like he says lower down in the article at some point about the differences in the hippocampus among patients with major depressive disorder, he notes that patients with other mental disorders also have problems in their hippocampus. It's not isolated to that one particular thing. And people who were studying that particular disease, well, of course, they're going to focus on that one disease and say, well, the hippocampus is different in people with MDD than it is in healthy people. But if they had included in their study people with schizophrenia, people with OCD, they would find that their hippocampuses were different too. So it's not useful as a diagnostic tool in that case. It's maybe scientifically interesting to note that there is a difference there. It might provide some insights into possible treatments, but it wouldn't necessarily be a biological marker.
Right. Yeah. And any more than, the sort of, if somebody complains of fatigue, at one point there was a study done by someone who, studies mononucleosis, did a study that said that leads to fatigue. That doesn't mean that anytime somebody has fatigue, it's like, well, they probably have mononucleosis.
Right. And so we need to find biological markers that are more strongly correlated with that disease, or other markers, symptoms, basically, that are strongly correlated to a specific disease. And what he points out here in this article is that we keep falling back on symptoms, behavioral symptoms, and life events and things like that for diagnoses, because again and again, they strongly correlate with very specific mental disorders, whereas the biological markers really don't, and people seem to have massaged the data to make it look as if they do, when if you pick it apart, they don't.
Yeah, and that very much goes to this idea of having a structured diagnostic approach, where if you're really trying to get a specific diagnosis, then you really do need to have this more of a flowchart thing so that it really addresses all of the different ways of deciding whether a symptom of fatigue or insomnia is due to one thing or another thing. And it makes sense that the first thing you do is you figure out if there's some very physical answer, that so you don't go down a rabbit hole. Maybe the diagnosis of fatigue is because they ran a marathon and then came home to a screaming baby and didn't get any sleep. And so that says nothing about their mental health, but it would be an obvious reason why somebody would be really, really fatigued.
Exactly. Did you look at the Twitter thread that is referenced in this article?
Yes, there's a Twitter thread at the bottom that talks about why depression is not a good phenotype for research in clinical psychology, psychiatry, or medicine. And I thought that was fantastic.
Yes, and the very first, or I guess it's the second item in Fried's thread, says that there are over 280 scales to assess depression severity, and he shows a diagram comparing the most popular 50 of them, and I had no idea there was such a wide variation in how depression is diagnosed. And I will tell you, so I was diagnosed with postpartum depression, and they used a scale to determine it, but I think at that point it was fairly obvious that something was wrong. People around me could see it, even I could tell something wasn't right. And so it was, a fairly straightforward diagnosis. And so I was treated for postpartum depression, and through all the various medication and support groups and therapy and all that. So years later, I kept going to various doctors to sort of maintain my mental health, seeing counselors and things, even though I was obviously, the kids were grown, I no longer had postpartum depression, but being treated to make sure that depression didn't come back. And a couple of years ago, when I went to a new psychiatric practice, they said, "Oh, okay, I see you've been diagnosed with major depressive disorder." And I said, "I have." I don't think I'm majorly depressed. But then I found out that one of the criteria is how long you have had it. So if you have been treated for depression for over a certain number of years, then it's classified as major depressive disorder, even though it's might not have been crippling or serious form of depression for more than a couple of months out of that entire span of years, just because you've been treated for it over a long time. It's classified as the same disease as people who have to be institutionalized. And I guess that goes to show just, how little specificity there is in that particular diagnosis.
Yeah, and that's goes with this, making distinctions between different diagnoses, and that's what I thought was really great about this Twitter thread is this, especially if you're hunting for, say, a biological marker, like a he talks about these genome-wide association surveys, and if you're trying to have a tag that says, okay, when we'll look for everybody who has a diagnosis of major depression and everybody who doesn't, then you may be just grouping all sorts of different uncorrelated things together, and you might on one side you might have everyone who for cultural or financial reasons never sought out treatment, and on the other side you have this whole range of people diagnosed on 200 different scales. At a certain point, you wonder, am I really gonna get, I'm using this very high tech tool to try to find statistical significance in single nucleotide differences in DNA, but is it just a case of garbage in, garbage out if I'm just mushing everything together?
It's kind of like researching cancer. Well, cancer is a real diagnosis, but there's so many different types and there's so many different kinds. It would not be a good study to say, okay, I'm going to look at people who have cancer versus people who don't. Well, you might have somebody with melanoma versus somebody who has lung cancer in the same group, and they're not going to have the same symptoms at all.
Well, so there's with cancer though, we've developed knowledge about we've developed some systematic knowledge about how cancer cells, what's required for a cancer cell to create enough of itself to become a problem. And those have really we've kind of figured that out. And okay, if it's gonna if cancer is going to exist, then it needs to change, X, Y, and Z in terms of cell machinery, or else it won't continue to be a cancer. It'll be just a either a cell that's a little bit weird, or it'll be killed off by the immune system. So we kind of have some systematic information, and that lets us know what kinds of things to look for.
Right, but we got that information by doing more specific studies. Whereas if researchers had studied disparate types of cancer altogether in the beginning, it would have been much more difficult to come up with good results like that. If you study everybody who has lung cancer and come up with something, and then you study everybody who has skin cancer and you come up with something, then you can compare across the studies and see where they're similar because each study is, inherently rigorous and specific.
And even then, there's the different. It depends on whether you're looking at trying to make a diagnosis of cancer versus then trying to figure out what caused it. And I think that's one of the things that this article talks about a little bit in terms of how, especially when you're talking about the brain as a whole, it's very dangerous to say that the size of the hippocampus is what caused some, the hippocampus is small, so that caused some sort of brain disorder, as opposed to say somebody has a mental health issue, and because of the feedback with that mental health issue and the way that your brain gets used and not used in different ways, that can cause the hippocampus to shrink.
Right. He mentions that people who have Alzheimer's and people who don't get enough exercise also have smaller hippocampuses. So, does that mean that lack of exercise shrinks the hippocampus, which causes depression? We don't really know. But like you said, it's depending too much on biological descriptions of mental disorders removes the research into what might have caused them and what external factors, external to the body, are continuing to influence the disease and possibly influence physiology, which influences the disease. And how much is the disease influencing your physiology? Because if you're depressed and don't feel like exercising, well, that, or you're sleeping all the time, that is certainly going to influence your physiology as well.
I think it's tricky also because a lot of these diagnoses are, it's not a clean thing like having malaria, where it's definitely the malaria, there's a malaria parasite and you don't want it there. If somebody has some sort of eating disorder, the solution isn't to stop eating.
Right.
It's some sort of, it's a behavioral, it's a, there's all sorts of things that get wrapped up into what it is to be a human and all sorts of things. And it even, going back to sort of the brain size, there's been studies of if you're a very serious violinist, then you can see that on a brain scan because the area of the brain that controls the not the bowing hand but the other hand, that gets more highly developed because you spend a lot of, if you're a professional violinist, you spend a lot of time doing fine control of that hand.
Well, as much as this article tries to, get us away from depending too much on biological markers for diagnosing mental illness, I think it shows a lot of promise for encouraging more specificity in diagnosing mental illness and maybe breaking down broad categories into more specific categories and looking at subcategories of particular diseases to see what they have in common or how they're different. And I think if there was more research done on that, it might provide better diagnostic tools in the future.
Yes. There's always more research to be done. And one thing we haven't talked too much about, and is something that gets talked a lot about, not so much in a go back and forth between psychology and psychiatry, but in sort of psychology and anti-psychology almost, is the extent to which, and he talks about this a little, is how diagnosis is culturally specific, how behavior that in one context is considered normal, in another context is considered abnormal. And particularly, a classic example is the way that is proper to behave in a war zone is not proper to behave not in a war zone. And so that would be given a diagnosis. And there's a lot of question about how much of our psychological machinery is premised on the lifestyle of the college-going North American.
Yes, I remember reading something recently about that, how the people who tend to get recruited to these studies tend to be people who are either at universities or around and near universities, and that skews the data. So you don't get people in rural areas of South America showing up for these studies, and you don't know if the results are globally applicable or if they just apply to that particular small group of people you were able to test.
When I the, there's that, and there's also this part of it where there's a sense of it, the people who are making the determination of what is considered normal exist within a particular cultural context.
That's a good point too, and what's considered normal in China is different than what's considered normal in Finland, for example, culturally. So, do you know of much research that has been done to look into that sort of thing?
Well, it ends up being that's the whole field of anthropology in a sense. And then you get into the question of where's the dividing line between so-called hard science and so-called soft science? And you can definitely bet that anyone who is a psychiatrist would say that they do hard science, although they do it on the edge of what you can figure out. And then on the other hand, you have the extreme other end, which would be sort of cultural criticism, which is all the way on the soft side, but they would maybe say that the psychiatrists aren't doing as firm science as they think they are.
Well,
And that
you've touched on something that I think is possibly behind this whole initial push to reduce mental diagnoses down to biological diseases. And that's the desire to look more like hard science. You know, it's I wonder how much of that is psychologists wanting to say, look, we are real scientists, we are not fuzzy. I mean, and they aren't. It is real science. But I'm sure they get a lot of grief from biologists and doctors and people who, the medical doctors, they are medical doctors, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
But.
and it's exactly, and the NIH will give you money for an fMRI machine. But it will not give you the same sort of money to do an intensive group therapy session.
Right. And a doctor I talked to last year said that, well, studies have shown that for talk therapy and group therapy, there's a certain amount of time that studies have shown is optimal to improve disorders in people who have PTSD and depression and addiction issues. But, insurance will not pay for the full amount of time that is required. And I don't know if it's just insurers being insurers and trying to cut things short, but it's about half the time that is actually needed because to some degree it's like, well, they're just talking. Can't they just talk faster, talk more? You know, why do you really need 3 months of therapy, can't we just get it done in one? So, anything that is not hard physical data, you can't say, well, look, after, you know, 20 chemotherapy sessions, that's when the cancer goes away, or after so many treatments of antibiotics, that's when the virus is gone. It's harder to say, you know, it takes this many therapy sessions for the PTSD to go away.
Yeah, or to be under control.
Right.
It's a much harder. It's easier to just sort of be arbitrary on if it's not a number of pills or something, for sure.
It's an interesting cultural commentary that I've thought a lot about how so many people, at least in North America, don't trust things that they can't see and measure empirically.
One last thing I wanted to say, which was one of the things that he talks about, and going back to the genome-wide association studies, is that there's a lot of great research being done on those right now. And even if, we can't say that we know that we can't really pin down a lot of mental health issues to a specific genes or even 400 genes or anything. There's this approach called the polygenic scores, and I'm curious if we're going to see more about that and if that can tell us more in the future about susceptibilities to certain mental health issues, simply because this is where they take all sorts of different little pieces of information, and when you start to add them up, it can actually give you a higher percent chance of being correct on certain things. And for instance, right now, you look at somebody's DNA, you can actually guess how tall they are. And it's not because there's one particular gene that controls that, but if you add up all the interactions between a whole bunch of different things, we figured out that that tells you, this one says taller, this one says shorter, this other one says taller, but only if this other one is there. And that gives you some idea of how tall somebody will become. And my guess is that that might give some sort of score about susceptibilities to certain things, or it's not a genes or destiny, but genes are propensities.
That is a very promising area of research, and I look forward to hearing more about what people discover as they look into that more.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Artist Materialist. You can find us at artistmaterialist.com. Please rate, review, and recommend to a friend who is also fighting about clinical diagnoses.